This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Floor 38.
I'm so excited to be having a conversation with someone when they have that revelation.
Packer seems to be interested in that. John McPhee has brought this up.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today on the show, we're going to meet a woman with the weirdest job you've ever heard of, and we're going to hear a story about a school year from hell by a master of short fiction, Donald Bartlemy.
With the herb gardens, it was probably a case of overwatering, and at least now they know not to overwater. The children were very conscientious with the herb gardens, and some of them probably, you know, slipped them a little extra water when we weren't looking. Or maybe, well, I don't like to think about sabotage, although it did occur to us. I mean, it was something that crossed our minds. We were thinking that way probably because before that, the gerbils had died, and the white mice had died, and the salamander. Well, now they know not to carry them around in plastic bags.
That's later this hour. One of the many incredible things about this presidential election, and none of us can count them at this point, is that Gary Johnson, a two-term governor of New Mexico and a former CEO of a company that sells marijuana products, is currently polling at around 8% in matchups against Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. In order to make it onto the presidential debate stage, he'll need to poll at 15%, but even if that doesn't happen, he's still on track to capture the largest share of the third-party vote for president since Ross Perot in the 1990s. On cultural issues, the libertarians are often to the left of many Democrats, and on fiscal issues, they're often to the right of most mainstream Republicans. So they have enemies on all sides, and they make for some pretty strange alliances. But with the Republican Party now so fractured and chaotic thanks to Donald Trump, this could be the year that a party of the sidelines moves closer to the center of American politics. Governor, I have to begin in the following way. There's just no way around it. Your former party, the Republican Party, seems to be in a state of chaos and even crack up. And you yourself have recently denounced Donald Trump, at least obliquely, as an authoritarian. When you were asked about it, you said, if it walks like a duck, et cetera, et cetera. As somebody who was a two-time governor, and a loyal Republican, although now running as a libertarian, give me your analysis of the Republican Party. Where is it now?
Well, I think it's I think this is the demise of the Republican Party. I think that I think Donald Trump alienates more than half of Republicans, and you know, I've said this for a while now that I think most Republicans are about small government, and really that's just been co-opted. The deportation of 11 million undocumented workers, that's just founded in misinformation. They're not taking jobs that U.S. citizens want. Building a wall across the border, that's crazy. Killing the families of Muslim terrorists, that's crazy. he's all for free trade, but, you know, he's going to impose a tariff on imported goods. Who's going to pay for that? And you're going to force Apple to make their iPads and their iPhones in the United States? It just goes on and on and on.
But you're happy with him about guns.
Happy with him about guns? By happy, I support the Second Amendment. I don't know what he... I don't know where he's at on any of these issues.
And yet you've had nice things to say about Hillary Clinton, notably on CNN. You talked about her as a competent and serious public servant.
Well, you know, I'd change that. I think, you know, sometimes you misspeak a little bit. I really do think that this whole... Clinton Foundation is pay to play, and I've wondered a long time about these speaking fees that Bill Clinton has gotten, and just of late, for me personally, I've been able to connect the dots, and really, it's not a good thing.
Do you worry that there's any scenario in which a third party candidate could have a historic negative in many people's minds? Scenario as with Ralph Nader affecting things in a way that led to something that you came to hate, like the Iraq War?
Well, I think a wasted vote is voting for somebody that you don't believe in. And given the fact that these are the two most polarizing figures of all time and space that have ever run from the two major parties in the same race, I don't lose any sleep over that one.
Governor, since the path to winning is hugely dependent on getting to the debates and then performing in the debates. When you imagine yourself as a third party on a stage with Donald Trump, the Republican, and Hillary Clinton as the Democrat, how do you imagine that debate going and how in your mind and how it goes well for you? Why would you...
Intimidate the two of them too much. You know, having been governor of New Mexico for two terms, having more executive experience than the two of them, I just, you know, not to fear. I'm not going to throw rocks. I'll leave that for others. But I would really like to talk about policy.
And where would the avenues of attack or avenues of explanation be? What I'm having a difficult time, Governor, is latching on to the one or two big themes in your campaign in terms of policy, and I'd like to tease that out.
Well, smaller government, that we would be proposing a balanced budget. To propose a balanced budget, you have to reform the entitlements. You can't do that without reforming the entitlements, Medicaid and Medicare. Social Security is headed for a fiscal cliff, so there's reform to Social Security, not cutting it, but reform so that it is around in the future. And then you can't balance the federal budget unless you're going to actually cut the military.
So tell me how to reform Medicare and Medicaid. People tend to like the benefits that they do have once they become part of the culture. What are the specifics on how you would lower costs on Medicare and Medicaid? Would you change the ages? I mean, how would you deal with Social Security to stabilize it?
Well, you are talking about a potentially regarding Social Security. I do believe that the retirement age needs to get raised.
To what?
Look, I'm not getting elected king or dictator here. I'm looking to get elected president of the United States. That has constitutional limits, so I either get to support or not support what comes out of Congress. I would recommend raising the retirement age. 72 seems like a good starting point. Mm-hmm. With regard to Medicaid and Medicare, I believe that Medicaid has to devolve to the states.
Would you roll back Obamacare, as some people on the Republican side of the aisle have urged?
Well, I think the cat is out of the box, but when it comes to reforming our healthcare system, I think what is needed is a free market approach to healthcare. And I'll just add that healthcare is as far removed from free market as it possibly can be.
Is there a free market medical system somewhere in the world that you admire?
I can't think of a single one.
You've been honest about and funny about, in both the New Yorker piece about you by Ryan Lizen and many other venues, about smoking marijuana and having eating edibles. The last time you got high was with a Chiba Chew, Ryan. Lizza reports, a Colorado brand that High Times once called America's favorite edible. And yet you've sworn off now. And I wonder why. You know, Barack Obama certainly ends a working day very often with a martini or two. Why do you feel duty-bound to do that?
Well, the whole notion of inbound missiles, you got 12 minutes to deal with that. I have never advocated being on the job impaired. And running for president is a 24/7 job, and being president is a 24/7 job. You know, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 29 years. That had to do with being the best that I could be. My whole life is about health and wellness and fitness, and I take great pride in it. So I hope when it comes to my admission that the last time I consumed marijuana was 3 months ago, I hope more than anything that people would just recognize that here's a guy who tells the truth. And if you tell the truth, you know, it's really hard to do harm to somebody who's telling the truth regardless of the consequences.
You've been very bold and direct about declaring the war on drugs in general a gigantic failure. What policy direction would you take as president regarding drugs beyond marijuana?
Well, I have never advocated anything but the legalization of marijuana. I think when we legalize marijuana, when the whole country comes to have that pass, I think we're going to take a giant leap as a nation and understand first and foremost that drugs are a health issue rather than a criminal justice issue. And if we start looking at harm reduction strategies, and by that, reducing death, disease, crime, corruption, the things that we genuinely care about, that we will actually accomplish that.
What's the path to accomplishing that? I think many people have said what you've said, but when it comes to a full medicalization and legalization path, as we've seen in some countries, it's a very, very rocky road.
Well, just take an example of, and here I'm sitting in Burlington, but if Burlington wanted to deal with a heroin overdose epidemic, and I don't know what the heroin situation here is in Burlington.
It's horrendous in Vermont.
Well, okay, so how do you do—
In New England generally, it's been terrible.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, that's a situation everywhere. Well, if communities really genuinely cared about that, and look, this is not a federal government issue, but if communities really cared about it, they'd set up a clinic for testing of heroin. Bring your heroin in. You're not going to get arrested. Bring your heroin in, and we'll test it to tell you whether or not it's going to kill you or not. And that would be a harm reduction strategy.
Governor, I'm a little confused on your anti-gun control views. In the wake of the mass shooting in Orlando, where 49 people were killed, you had said that Americans would be safer if guns were more readily available, not more restricted. Now, I'm a little unclear why you think this is the case. I understand your support of the Second Amendment and your interpretation of it, but we should even be selling guns to people who are on terrorist watch lists? I mean, play a role here?
So, David, I'm not sure where you got this people should have more guns. I have
USA Today.
Pardon me?
Well, USA Today.
No. I have no doubt that you're quoting something, but I don't think I've ever advocated, look, everybody should have more guns. A situation like Orlando, I hope everybody paid attention to what happened in Orlando. I hope all the nightclub owners in the country were paying attention to the fact that all the doors were padlocked.
Okay, but I don't think you're arguing that egress in and out of the nightclub was the question. We're talking about the ready availability of weapons that one would think should be limited, I would think, and maybe we obviously disagree,
field of war. Limited. Let's talk for a second about semi-automatic rifles. That's a category of rifle that there are over 30 million of them in this country. And if you're going to make those criminal, I think you're going to have a whole new criminal class of people that aren't going to turn in those weapons.
Do you think it's a good thing that those guns are available?
Well, they are available. It's semi-automatic rifle. There are no—
Okay, but you're running for president. What's your position on whether they should be or not? This is a hot debate in American
political
life.
Should be or not, we should be allowed to exercise our Second Amendment rights, David, which would be the ability to own a semi-automatic rifle.
So that's your position.
Yes.
Should teachers for example, is it a good idea for
teachers? I'm not going to tell teachers whether or not they should have a gun or not. Come on, man.
No, it's not come on, man. It's a question
yeah, it's
of
come
should,
on, man.
Should if a, is it a good idea for a teacher to have it in classrooms, as has been suggested
if,
many
if
times
a
before?
If a teacher would deem that to be to avail the classroom of potentially being secure, or if the teacher were to deem that something that within their own purview they might prevent an atrocity if it were to occur, I would support the teacher in wanting to be able to do that.
Okay. There's one form of government that I'm not sure of your attitude toward. You are a committed environmentalist, as I understand it, and you also support the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, as so far as I understand it. Isn't that another form of big government? It certainly is to some on the right.
Well, government is if anyone believes that there isn't a 20% largesse in government, we're not on the same page. That said, I do think that the EPA comes under the fundamental heading of protecting us, and that government exists to protect us against individuals, groups, corporations, foreign governments that would do us harm. And I put pollution in the category of harm, and having been governor of New Mexico, but for the federal EPA, there would still be a major polluter existing in northern New Mexico that, because they refused to clean up, as governor, I was able to designate them as a Superfund site, which was about the heaviest anvil that I had to had in my bag.
Governor, politics apart, what would you say is the most formative experience in your life? Had helped shape who you are?
Well, I think it's a unique combination of being an entrepreneur and an athlete, and then my family. I mean, it's and that's no different than most people, but that has focused my life. I'm an optimistic character. I'm somebody who recognizes that failure is a part of everyday life, and it's ultimately how you deal with failure that determines success.
Did you have a failure that was formative to you?
Growing my business from a one-person handyman, me, to 1,000 employees, I have to tell you that along the way, death was not worse than the life I was living, which was just keeping up with cash flow and growth and the failure and the, you know, it was not easy. It was not easy. It was incredibly hard work. You know, like so many, I survived and went on to what I'll call great success.
Governor, are there a few books that you could say that encapsulate your philosophy of either governing or of life itself?
You know, Ayn Rand. I love The Fountainhead. I love Atlas Shrugged. I do read, but those are a couple of books that I think, from a philosophical standpoint, I think Fountainhead is my favorite book.
Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico and a candidate for the White House on the Libertarian ticket. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A writer named Laura Parker recently introduced us to a woman who's got a pretty odd job. Her name is Melody Doering, and she works at the American Museum of Natural History, that grand old place on the Upper West Side with the magnificent dinosaurs and the blue whale hanging from the ceiling. Now, on the books, Melody is a curatorial assistant. That's her title. What she actually does is run a kind of beauty salon at the museum, and it's exclusively for dead bees.
One Sunday, I was reading the New York Times into the science section, which is so far from my background as to be unbelievable. And I saw this little ad, and it almost glowed with a green light, and it said insect preparator. And I said, there is no such word. And I rejiggered my resume to put all sorts of crafty things on, like knitting and crocheting and handicrafts. And then I was brought in for a pinning test.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the pinning test was about, like what you had to do?
There was a box of dead bugs and a bunch of pins.
And you had to stick pins
in
the bugs?
And I had to stick pins in the bugs, yes. Yes, that's basically what it was.
So the museum actually has about 33 million specimens in its collection, and 500,000 of those are just bees. So if you were to put all the bees together, it'd be about 5 kilometers of bees, which is like, what, just over 3 miles?
Because bees have branched fur, the hairs are branched. If they get wet, they clump and they look like sad puppies or wet kittens. So what we try to do is restore them to the best possible state that they can be in.
The specimens are actually in jars full of alcohol, and that, you know, to preserve them. And that makes them super crispy and kind of gross, like they're all like crumpled up. So she picks them out of the alcohol using tweezers.
All right, the first thing I do is take some deionized water and put it in a jar. And then I take my shampoo, which is a non-ionic surfactant suitable for use as a detergent, wetting agent, emulsifier, and a mild detergent. And it only takes just a bead, and I shake it up, and you can see how much suds we get from that.
So you're popping 3 bees into the little bottle with the shampoo.
Putting the lid on, mm-hmm, and giving it a gentle agitation.
Okay, so you've used the tweezers to take them out of the shampoo, and you're just going to drain them. Oh, no, you're rinsing them.
Yep, got to rinse.
Doing a rinse. Rinse. A little pipette.
You wouldn't want to walk around with shampoo in your hair.
That's very true. So now they've been cleaned, but they still look a little shriveled. They're kind of opening up a little.
Well, sad puppy.
Still sad puppy.
Yes. So then I use the largest pin we use and pierce it through the thorax, slightly to the right of the midline and slightly behind the wing bud. Okay, now they are ready to go.
So and now they're in the blow drying station?
Yes.
And we're ready to blow dry?
Yes.
Now, instead of using a regular blow dryer, like the kind you get from a drugstore, she uses a very specific piece of scientific equipment called an air mattress inflator. So what happened was that she used to use a blow dryer, but she found that the force of the air was actually blowing the extremities off the bees and they were kind of losing legs left, right and center. So she needed something that was a little bit more gentle, and she was experimenting one day and she discovered that using an air mattress inflator was the best thing. Can you tell us a little bit about why the bees are mostly female?
Well, my smart answer is that they don't need pianos to be moved.
I don't get it. I don't get it.
There was the old joke about the only reason to have a man around is when you need the piano, moved.
Oh, I get you.
When males are needed for reproduction at certain times of the year, they are produced. Otherwise...
Oh, otherwise we don't need them around.
So until we need them to...
That makes perfect sense. I'm on board.
Move the piano.
To move the piano. And we're doing little quotation marks around move the piano. All right. So after they've finished drying off, Melody, you take them in and look at them under this elaborate microscope.
And I take each bee with a little sable brush and I fluff up her hair.
She's kind of regained some of her color.
Yes. When their yellow hair gets wet, it just looks like black.
Of this entire bee washing process and drying, how many bees would you be able to do kind of in one session? Because it takes, what, 10, 15 minutes to do one?
Yes. I wouldn't do more than 20 or 30 at one time.
And where is this box going to go now that you've finished?
Well, once we've gotten the information from the registrar, I will make up labels and then I will take them over to the office of the bee curator, and then we will have 8,500,003.
Melody Doering, curatorial assistant and keeper of the Bee Salon at the American Museum of Natural History. She spoke with the writer, Laura Parker.
I mean, it sort of started off when I was thinking about what to do after PayPal, and I'd always been interested in space, but I sort of started looking into it, and I went to the NASA website to find out when we're going to Mars. It seems like, obviously, that is the next thing after the moon, and I couldn't find anything.
Over the last few years, the inventor and tech mogul Elon Musk has been making headlines, claiming that his company, SpaceX, will somehow transport humans to Mars in the next 10 years or so. This effort is extremely difficult, as we've seen this week, when there was an explosion on the SpaceX launch pad. No one was hurt, but it was a setback. Later this month, Musk is supposed to release his detailed plan for how he exactly intends to set up a colony on the red planet. Other privately funded companies, as well as NASA and some foreign governments, are all starting to talk about a Mars colony, not as science fiction, but as a reality in my lifetime, or at least yours. It's a subject very dear to the heart of The New Yorker's Josh Rothman.
There's never been a time when I have not been fascinated by the idea of going to Mars. I grew up as a science fiction kid, reading sci-fi novels and watching sci-fi television shows. I even had a dream recently where I was a Martian colonist having different adventures. So it's obviously still alive for me. But there are a lot of people who I really respect who think it's a bad idea. So I thought I would talk to another writer here at The New Yorker, Elizabeth Colbert, she's like the office's Mars skeptic. And about a year ago, she wrote an article for the magazine called Project Exodus. It's basically an argument for why we shouldn't go to Mars.
Would you have wanted to go to space yourself?
I would definitely go. Actually a kind of an area of regret in my life that I feel like through historical accident I was born too early. Well,
maybe Elon Musk will rectify that.
Maybe I can retire to a space hotel or something. Yeah. But that's not quite as exciting. So at the end of your piece, you talk about the fact that essentially we have a nice planet here. We've evolved to live on the Earth. And you end the piece by talking about the idea that maybe it would make more sense to tend our own garden on Earth.
Well, one of the things that intrigued me in writing that piece, and I read several books by people who were very boosterish about going to Mars, and one of the refrains that kept being repeated and is actually also used by Elon Musk as a rationale for going to Mars is that, well, you know, we're trashing the Earth and we can't afford, we need this quote-unquote insurance policy of another planet. And to me, that seems so, you know, ludicrous as to be interesting, because if you look at what we would have to do to reduce the Earth to the unlivability of Mars. Okay, so let's just review what Mars doesn't have that is useful to have for life. Oxygen, okay? Air pressure. You can't take a step outside of a pressurized compartment in Mars. Water, liquid water, to the extent that there's water on Mars, and that's debated, it's not in liquid form, so it's not in a usable form. So we would have to reduce the Earth to a place with no water, no air pressure, and no oxygen to make it as unlivable as Mars. And I am, someone who's of the opinion that we're treating the planet very badly, but it's still pretty hard to imagine how we could get to that point. And then you're saying, okay, well, Mars is an alternative to the Earth. It just doesn't kind of add up, in my view.
So one of the things that everyone, I think, has been captivated by is Mars One, where there's this idea that you'd go on a one-way trip, and large numbers of people have signed up for that one-way trip.
Right, which I want to say really, really freaks me out personally, but yes, yes.
I mean, I could be wrong here. I'm going to go out on a limb, but I mean, I think there's even something in the idea of the one-way trip to Mars that you don't return from it. I guess it's parallel a little bit to exploring the quote-unquote new world that, that was a one-way trip for a lot of people. I mean—
Right.
But what do you think motivates it, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I'm the kind of person, who really likes oxygen and things like that. So I may be the wrong person to ask on that. But I once interviewed a very eminent biologist who described this as the madness gene. We are as a species, we've been venturing beyond the edge of the known world for a very, very long time. And he used the example of Easter Island. People somehow arrived at Easter Island, which is this tiny speck in the Pacific. And there must have been a lot of people who were lost along the way. And we keep going. Every place that's unexplored, we had the people who went to the polar north, and many, many dozens, hundreds of people were lost there. And you read these gruesome accounts of how they survived. And they went, in many cases, knowing that it was going to be extremely difficult and quite possibly fatal. And they still went. So obviously there is this, I don't know if it's genetic or cultural or what, but there is this tremendous desire to go where no one has gone before.
Okay, so Betsy makes some good points. That said, there are a lot of people out there who apparently do have that madness gene, and they want to go to Mars, even if it's a crazy plan. One of them is a guy named Jacob Hock-Misra. He's a researcher at the Blue Marble Space Institute of Science. And a few months ago, he co-authored a paper called A Pragmatic Approach to Sovereignty on Mars. And the paper is basically a detailed proposal for how the government of Mars might really work. How will it function? How will the colonies interact with each other? How will we settle disputes there? How will we manage to live in a place with such scarce resources? So you've engaged with this world in a lot of different ways. So you have the academic writing that you do. You've written a couple science fiction novels. I mean, I have to say, as an enthusiast of a sort of a big sci-fi reader, going through your CV, I felt like my life had taken a wrong turn somewhere and I should have been doing what you're doing.
I appreciate that.
It's totally amazing. Let's suppose that we really do succeed in colonizing Mars. It's the year 2030 and we've succeeded in sending enough people to Mars that now we have, multiple colonies. What's the worst case scenario?
I think one of the worst case scenarios is that we repeat some of the destructive patterns of human history, where you've got different factions on a planet that fail to learn how to solve some of their geopolitical problems. They fail to solve some of the problems of the commons and how to share resources. And so you end up getting conflict and possibly violent conflict. And I think in space, you're so much further away from the militaries on Earth that that could potentially be even more catastrophic than something like that on Earth.
So I have a tall order for you. Is it possible for you to just give me an example of a scenario, like an intercolonial dispute of some kind that you – is the type of dispute that you envision happening on a sort of early colonial Mars?
Sure, sure. So let's say that SpaceX is the first to go to Mars and they establish a colony near the polar ice caps, which would make sense because water is going to be one of the first resources that you need to sustain your colony. So SpaceX establishes themselves. There's no exclusive economic zone or anything. They just start mining water and taking up whatever space they need. 5 years later, 10 years later, the Chinese space exploration team shows up and they land in a very similar site. And they may very quickly be going after similar reserves of water. And that would very quickly lead to direct conflict where you're competing for the same resources.
And that would have repercussions back on Earth too, presumably, right?
That presumably would. Politics in space will correlate to politics on Earth.
Right. So, I mean, one of the questions I always have about this, it's easy for me to imagine, you know, year one through year 50 of Mars colonization being completely awesome. And then I basically imagine as soon as profit enters into it, like we discover massive uranium deposits under Mars, or we figure out how to sell water from the polar ice caps to newly arriving colonists, and there's now a Martian water baron, or, you know, whatever I imagine some science fictional type scenario in which basically as Mars becomes more of a fully functioning economy, it's just going to be exactly like, if anything, a more competitive and more capitalist environment than it is now. I mean, is there some sense you have that we could avoid that fate somehow, avoid the sort of reversion to the mean of human nature?
Yeah, I like to hope so. And I like to hope that maybe some of these the ways that capitalistic tendencies have played out, maybe they're not so indicative of human nature. The more I've thought about this, the less I tend to shy away from commercial interests, because without a profit motive, there's only a very limited set of things you can do with grants and donations and pure science. And I'm a scientist, so obviously I think very highly of those things. What I would like to see for, you know, year 50 plus in a Mars colony is that during those first 50 years that Mars has had enough autonomy, whatever that looks like, that they can that the Mars colonists can start developing new concepts of how to build an economy. I think that's not unrealistic. You know, one parallel I like to think about is art. You know, we have music and visual art and performance art on Earth today, but after 50 years on Mars, the colonists are definitely going to have different music and different visual art and different performance art simply because they're in a different environment forging their own culture. So I have to imagine that it's also possible that we could have different concepts of how an economy should behave if the Martians at least are able to determine some of that for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is there a do you feel that envisioning this future on Mars is a source of hope in your life?
It makes me feel like we have an open future. Maybe that's a better way to put it. I don't know if it's going to be good or bad, but the future is very open and we have a lot of possibility. You know, the astronomer Frank Drake, who was the astronomer to conduct the first search for extraterrestrial intelligence around nearby stars, he's remarked that SETI, searching for extraterrestrials, is a search for ourselves. And I think that applies equally well to any kind of space colonization. We're really putting ourselves in an extreme environment and learning how we respond and how we can thrive in that.
So I was just thinking about Mars this morning. So I live on Long Island and in a town that's by the Long Island Sound. And sometimes I'll go swimming in the Sound and it's extremely beautiful. And you know, wonderful to be on the Earth, basically. And I was just thinking about, having just had this conversation with Jacob, what a bummer it would be to live on Mars. I mean, the, mm-hmm. there's, you know, I wonder, is living in an artificial environment really living?
Yes, right, right. And there are no other living things. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a completely lifeless planet. Now, are we indifferent to everything with which we share the planet, you know, which is, I should say, the source of all of our oxygen and all of our food and, you know, just trivialities like that, that we want to live on the on a lifeless planet. We consider that to be, you know, preferable to the planet that we have.
Yeah.
I mean, once again, I'm not necessarily the person, you know, to speak to this, because I'm not a big sci-fi fan, but I think my feeling is that is a big theme of sci-fi. You know, when you get to this place, where have you gotten? You know, that longing for home. I mean, we may long for Mars when we're on Earth, but think of, you know, Earth sickness. I don't know. We need a new term for it. What you would miss when you are on Mars.
That's Josh Rothman, archives editor at The New Yorker. He spoke with staff writer Elizabeth Colbert and with Jacob Huck Misra of the Blue Marble Space Institute. In a minute, Kelif Hassaneh shares one of his latest musical obsessions, the singer and songwriter Angel Olsen. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Kelif Hassaneh is a staff writer at the magazine, and he and I share a lot of interests. We've both covered sports, music, politics, but I've got to admit he's much better at me at keeping up on what's new. So, Kay, I try like crazy to keep pace with you, but I gather your latest enthusiasm is somebody I confess I've never heard of, and I really should, and that's Angel Olsen.
Yeah, I've been listening to her music a lot, and often when I really love something, it's partly because I'm slightly confused by it. And Angel Olsen makes this kind of mysterious, it's related to country music and folk music and the kind of old, weird American music, but she has what a lot of people in that world don't have, which is an incredible voice. I feel so lonesome, I could cry. But instead I'll pass the time. She's sometimes compared to Roy Orbison, and she has this kind of mournful, slightly quavering voice, and she uses it to make these songs that are really, really specific, but not quite so specific that you can figure them out.
I gather there's a song called Sister that you think is especially great.
Yeah, I mean, it's 8 minutes long, which is not what we were expecting on this record.
So and, like Visions of Johanna for today.
and Sister is this song that basically is two halves. It starts off really intense, and then something happens in the middle, and it switches, and it turns into this long sort of rock and roll fade out. And when she came by, I asked her to talk a little bit about it.
Thanks for coming to talk to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm wondering about this song, Sister. You know, it seems in some ways like kind of a sort of a focal point on the record. And you're probably, I don't know if you're now regretting an interview you gave a couple of years ago where you said that if you write a song that with mother or father or sister and people say, is that about your sister?
Yeah.
That you kind of can't be surprised or you can't blame
them.
Oh, no.
Just like I can't be surprised. I'm getting all kinds of like feminist and, you know, inquiries about the title of the record.
Because you called it My Woman.
Yeah. And so for Sister, it was more about, conjuring up the kind of a reflection of myself with someone who's really close to me and having a very special, like, love with them that's not necessarily romantic, or love with a person that's familial. But I also I'm just surprised by some of the pointed questions that I get. It feels like if I had said something else about it, or if it was called something else, that I wouldn't have gotten, like, if it was My Man, no one would have questioned it. You know what I mean? So it is an interesting conversation piece in a way.
Right. Can we listen to a little bit of it?
Yeah, that's fine. It's a little like watching myself naked in a room, but I'm down. In the studio, like with the speakers of the studio.
You mean loud or just better?
Better and loud, yeah. To be totally like encompassed. But yeah, there you go.
One thing that this song has that a lot of your songs have is a certain kind of like heightened intensity, like a super emotionally vivid sense. Were you always set on Sister being nearly 8 minutes long?
No, I had no idea when I wrote it that it was that long. And then I was like, you know, in some ways I think there are parts of this particular song that sort of nod to like Stevie Nicks or Neil Young, or in my head they do. I don't know if that comes across. Neil Young on the beach is a perfect example of that, in that like he just kind of lets go and just does what he wants in that song and makes it as long as possible. Like, I wanted to, there was definitely intent to take what I learned from hearing those kinds of songs and apply it to my own writing and my own singing.
Let's listen again to closer to the middle of the song, where we're kind of moving from one part into another. Oh, Even my questionable computer speakers will not dilute the mighty power of that song. That's the true test, I guess.
I didn't realize that by writing such a lengthy song that it would be reflecting the actual lyrical content of itself. And I, you know, just listening back, it's like you think it's about to be over in that moment, and then it's about to really go into the solo. And to me, that's what the song is about. It's like you think you know everything, or you think you know something or someone or whatever the situation is, like, really well, and that you've realized all this stuff about it. And then you live life a little bit longer, and you're shown over and over again, like, I don't have it all figured out.
Singer and songwriter Angel Olsen talking about her song Sister off the new record My Woman. She spoke with The New Yorker's Kelefasana. Now, this weekend is the official, unofficial end of summer. So you might be a little bummed out, but if you have kids in the house, you might want to throw a party to celebrate the start of the school year. Not to be grouchy, but you know what I mean. Years ago, the writer Donald Bartlemy published a story in The New Yorker about a school year from hell. It was called, simply, The School.
Well, we had all these children out planting trees, see, because we figured that that was part of their education, to see how, you know, the root systems and also the sense of responsibility, taking care of things, being individually responsible, you know what I mean. And the trees all died. They were orange trees. I don't know why they died. They just died. Something wrong with the soil, possibly, or maybe the stuff we got from the nursery wasn't the best. We complained about it. So we've got 30 kids there, each kid with his or her own little tree to plant, and we've got these 30 dead trees. All these kids looking at these little brown sticks. It was depressing. It wouldn't have been so bad, except that just a couple of weeks before the thing with the trees, the snakes all died. But I think that the snakes, well, the reason that the snakes kicked off was that, you remember, the boiler was shut off for 4 days because of the strike, and that was explicable. It was something you could explain to the kids because of the strike. I mean, none of their parents would let them cross the picket line, and they knew there was a strike going on and what it meant. So when things got started up again and we found the snakes, they weren't too disturbed. With the herb gardens, it was probably a case of overwatering, and at least now they know not to overwater. The children were very conscientious with the herb gardens, and some of them probably, you know, slipped them a little extra water when we weren't looking. Or maybe, well, I don't like to think about sabotage, although it did occur to us. I mean, it was something that crossed our minds. We were thinking that way probably because before that, the gerbils had died and the white mice had died. And the salamander, well, now they know not to carry them around in plastic bags. Of course, we expected the tropical fish to die. That was no surprise. Those numbers, you look at them crooked and their belly up on the surface. But the lesson plan called for a tropical fish input at that point. There was nothing we could do. It happens every year. You just have to hurry past it. We weren't even supposed to have a puppy. We weren't even supposed to have one. It was just a puppy the Murdoch girl found under a Gristiti's truck one day, and she was afraid the truck would run over it when the driver had finished making his delivery, so she stuck it in her knapsack and brought it to the school with her. So we had this puppy. As soon as I saw the puppy, I thought, oh, Christ, I bet it will live for about 2 weeks, and that's what it did. It wasn't supposed to be in the classroom at all. There was some kind of regulation about it, but you can't tell them they can't have a puppy when the puppy is already there right in front of them running around on the floor and yap, yap, yapping. They named it Edgar. That is, they named it after me. They had a lot of fun running after it and yelling, "Here, Edgar, nice, Edgar." Then they'd laugh like hell. They enjoyed the ambiguity. I enjoyed it myself. I don't mind being kidded. They made a little house for it in the supply closet and all that. I don't know what it died of. Distemper, I guess. It probably hadn't had any shots. I got it out of there before the kids got to school. I checked the supply closet each morning routinely because I knew what was going to happen. I gave it to the custodian. And then there was this Korean orphan that the class adopted through the Help the Children program. All the kids brought in a quarter a month. That was the idea. It was an unfortunate thing. The kid's name was Kim. And maybe we adopted him too late or something. The cause of death was not stated in the letter we got. They suggested we adopt another child instead and sent us some interesting case histories. But we didn't have the heart. The class took it pretty hard. They began, I think, nobody ever said it to me directly, to feel that maybe there was something wrong with the school. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the school particularly. I've seen better and I've seen worse. It was just a run of bad luck. We had an extraordinary number of parents passing away, for instance. There were, I think, 2 heart attacks, 2 suicides, 1 drowning, and 4 killed together in a car accident, 1 stroke. And we had the usual heavy mortality rate among the grandparents. Or maybe it was heavier this year. It seems so. And finally, the tragedy. The tragedy occurred when Matthew Wine and Tony Mavrogordo were playing over where they're excavating for the new federal office building. There were all these big wooden beams stacked, you know, at the edge of the excavation. There's a court case coming out of that. The parents are claiming that the beams were poorly stacked. I don't know what's true and what's not. It's been a strange year. I forgot to mention Billy Brandt's father, who was knifed fatally when he grappled with a masked intruder in his home. One day, we had a discussion in class. They asked me, where did they go? The trees, the salamander, the tropical fish, Edgar, the papas and mamas, Matthew and Tony, where did they go? And I said, I don't know, I don't know. And they said, who knows? And I said, nobody knows. And they said, is death that which gives meaning to life? And I said, no, life is that which gives meaning to life. And they said, but isn't death considered as a fundamental datum, the means by which the taken-for-granted mundanity of the everyday may be transcended in the direction of... I said, yes, maybe. They said, we don't like it. I said, that's sound. They said, it's a bloody shame. I said, it is. They said, will you make love now with Helen, our teaching assistant, so that we can see how it is done? We know you like Helen. I do like Helen, but I said that I would not. We've heard so much about it, they said, but we've never seen it. I said I would be fired and that it was never, or almost never, done as a demonstration. Helen looked out the window. They said, please, please, make love with Helen. We require an assertion of value. We are frightened. I said that they shouldn't be frightened, although I am often frightened, and that there was value everywhere. Helen came and embraced me. I kissed her a few times on the brow. We held each other. The children were excited. Then there was a knock on the door. I opened the door, and the new gerbil walked in. The children cheered wildly.
The School, a story published in 1974 by Donald Bartlemy. It was read by the actor Reed Burney. And that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Now, not long ago, we had the poet Max Ritvo on the show talking about his very funny and very grim poem, Poem to My Litter. It's about an experimental treatment that he was undergoing, which was a last resort in his struggle with cancer. We got the news last week that Max had died. He was a remarkable young man, and you'll hear in our interview that his spirit and his sense of humor never gave out. It's at newyorkerradio.org. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfiel, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Owen Agnew, Alex Barron, Becky Cooper, Eric Malinsky, and Corey Schreppel. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.